You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, it's exit stage right for Britain, at least according to London's mayor, who says it's time the UK stepped out of the European Union. David Cameron disagrees. We'll discuss the splits in the UK's governing party. Plus, there was no bang, merely a whimper. America's Bush dynasty is over as Jeb officially pulls out. So just how fractured is the GOP? And later in the programme, amid rigged results and claims of intimidation, we'll assess the tense aftermath of Uganda's election. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS at the University of London, and Jane Kinnamont, senior research fellow and deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Welcome to you both.
Good evening.
The battle for the future of Britain has begun. And if that sounds slightly hyperbolic, forgive me, but voters in the UK are about to make a rather important decision. The question is whether the country stays in the European Union or, as Prime Minister David Cameron puts it, takes a leap in the dark and leaves. Those in favour of leaving, like the Mayor of London and wannabe Prime Minister Boris Johnson, would describe it differently, of course. Standing on our own two feet, the Mayor said yesterday when he announced his decision to vote leave. So far, it's been billed as Dave versus Boris, but as the 4 months of campaigning drags on, one hopes the debates will broaden out a little. But Phil Clark, if we can begin with Dave versus Boris. David Cameron has always in public been very polite to Boris Johnson, an old school friend of his, old university pal of his, also, as he's described as, you know, one of the biggest beasts within the Tory party, one of his main players. And yet we've seen over the last 24 hours this split within the UK Conservative Party between those who want to stay and those who want to leave has really been ripped apart. And David Cameron is not taking any prisoners now, is he?
No, and Cameron was in the Commons today taking every possible swipe that he could at Boris without naming him directly. I think the real hope for the staying in crowd was that Cameron and Boris could form an allegiance and basically, you know, keep most Tory MPs on their side and thus influence the electorate in their direction. And I think maybe there was a certain complacency within Cameron's camp about the fact that Boris would jump on board. It seems to have caught them really off guard in the last week that he's gone for the exit crowd. So Cameron's got a lot of ground to try and catch up here.
Jenkins, how much do personalities matter in a debate like this? I mean, obviously, you know, for everything that the Remain people say, they would certainly have liked Boris on their side. He is a popular politician, if that's not an oxymoron. But when it comes down to it, do you think the personalities will have much sway?
I think they do as one of the factors in a debate that is quite complex, because the benefits and costs of being in the European Union are very wide-ranging, and they're also quite debatable, because there is just a huge unknown about what Britain's relationship with the rest of Europe would look like if it was out. So in this context of uncertainty, I think people do look to personalities, and it was quite striking that when Cameron was trying to undermine Boris's arguments, one of the things that he said was, we shouldn't make this leap in the dark, arm in arm with Nigel Farage, head of an eccentric right-wing outfit, UKIP, and George Galloway, a very eccentric
far-left politician.
And that was very clearly trying to tar Boris with the brush of more kind of fringe political personalities.
Phil Clark, that is the big advantage that the Leave campaign has now that they didn't have a week ago, is that, you know, a week ago their biggest names were Nigel Farage and George Galloway. And as popular as those two politicians may be with their base, they are not necessarily politicians who've proved to to attract majority support, are they?
No, that's right. I mean, Boris can't be described as a fringe dweller in any sense of the term. I mean, most polls suggest that he's the likeliest prime minister after Cameron. He's enormously popular. In fact, I was on the London Underground last week at about 11 o'clock at night and just happened to be in the same tube carriage as Boris. And you could watch him even at 11 o'clock at night. This man is just a pure politician. He has... I mean, for all of his buffoonery, he has this public touch. People listen to him. He has this bizarre sort of shambolic magnetism to him. He's enormously popular in the electorate because of that. And so he will lend a certain soundbite credibility to the exit campaign. It's a complete disaster for Cameron, and one that Cameron 10 days ago, I think, didn't believe would happen.
And it's interesting as well, Jane, when you look at Boris Johnson's record in London... You know, the actual record of what he's achieved, you know, once he leaves office later this year after 8 years as Mayor of London, that might be quite thin. But the big achievement really is the fact that he got elected in a city where, 45% of voters voted Labour at the last election, around about 20-something voted Tory. I mean, this is, you know, London is not a Tory city, and yet he's just had two terms as a very popular mayor.
That's true. We only have one other mayor to compare him with, Ken Livingstone, who wasn't in the Labour Party as well when he got elected. And the common thread that they have is that they were both mavericks within their own party, ideologically very different, but suggesting that Londoners like people who they think have big personalities and will stand up for London rather than representing other political parties. Ken was... highly cognizant of and arguably obsessive with the details of running London, waste, policing, transport management. Boris seems to be much less of a detail person, but he has actually centralised some powers in the mayor's office that Ken didn't have, particularly giving himself more say on how the police are run.
Phil, when we look at how this campaign pans out, you know, it's one thing looking at the Remain side and going, well, how Nigel Farage and George Galloway and Michael Gove and Boris Johnson all go campaign together. But it's also a little bit awkward when you see who's lined up for the Remain camp. There's David Cameron and George Osborne, and then there's some quite Eurosceptic but trying to see themselves as pragmatic ministers like Sajid Javid, like Theresa May. Then you've got Jeremy Corbyn and most of the Labour Party. Then you've got Nicola Sturgeon as well. This is a bit of a mix of people that don't normally talk to each other, let alone share political beliefs.
This campaign on both sides, I think, has become really, really messy in the last 10 days, but particularly for the Remain side. I think there was a feeling that they could wheel out a bunch of very palatable leaders who could speak with one voice. There would be a coherence to the agenda, and they would portray this sense of kind of calmness and being in control, and which is their argument about staying in the EU, that this is about calmness and staying in control in a very, very volatile international period. I think that has really been undermined in the last 10 days, that particularly for the Remain camp, they have many fewer MPs in both of the major parties than they perhaps hoped they would a couple of weeks ago. As you say, the profile of those personalities is highly conflictual in many senses. And so they're not going to be able to project the kind of public image and the public message that they really would like. It's going to be very, very messy for the Remain camp.
The good thing about this is that it isn't a partisan issue. People are going to be forced to argue it on, generally speaking, the merits, apart from occasionally going off into rants about how it's going to make us all vulnerable to terrorist attacks if we stay or leave, depending which side of the debate you're on, which has been a feature in recent days.
Yes, a particularly strange attack from Ian Duncan Smith yesterday, sort of half going off on one, suggesting that maybe because, well, look at France, all these people might come in and who knows what might happen.
And meanwhile, John Kerry sort of weighed into the debate as well, saying that it was very important that Europe stand together in the face of terrorism and, by the way, Britain should stay in, which seemed similarly de-linked from actual arguments.
Yes, one wonders how persuasive John Kerry will be in Doncaster or so on. Jane, I've got a Scottish question for you here. Because when you look at the polls, not only is it that the Scottish Nationalist Party are very pro the European Union, but Scotland generally is pro the European Union. And there has been some talk that were Britain to leave, that then might make people in Scotland think, well, look, we actually want to be part of the European Union. That's one of the big parts of us being part of the United Kingdom. We want a second referendum for Scottish independence. Do you think the issue of the UK's unitedness will come into this campaign much?
It should do, because there is a serious argument that if Britain left, then Scotland might actually choose the European Union over the United Kingdom's union. So it should be a part of the debate. It's probably something that Cameron would bring up against Boris Johnson, because keeping Scotland in the union has always been a feature of Conservative policy. But at the same time, it will be a difficult one for the SNP with the oil price so low. Campaigning for a new referendum very soon would also be quite difficult, because with oil at $30 a barrel, none of their budget sums add up.
And Phil, just finally on this point, how are you looking forward to this campaign? Because I've got to say, after the first couple of days, I think already people's eyes are starting to sort of slightly glaze over, and like, oh, we've got four more months of this. And there's very little of the debate is cutting through to what it really means. As Jane says, it's you can spin these statistics both ways, or both sides would argue anyway.
I think it's going to be a horrible debate. I'm really lamenting the next 4 months, and I've had a taste of this in the last week. Sort of, you know, watching particularly the British media, the British TV media in particular, talk about this issue. On the one hand, you've got this terrible sort of nationalism, xenophobia, patriotism on the Leave camp of the really ugliest form, a kind of, you know, Britain exceptionalism against, you know, the kind of overpowering burden of the European Union. That's terrible. Versus the sort of dense, impenetrable, technocratic approach that the Remain camp have used. And so you've got these two completely different forms of messaging that kind of talk past each other. And I just think it's going to be a very brusque, a very dull, and a probably very divisive debate over the next few months. I'm really, really worried about it.
Well, there we are. We have four more months of that, and I'm sure we'll be covering it in all its glory here on Monocle 24. Now, from one campaign to another. As Jeb Bush handed out small toy tortoises to children during the last weeks of his bid for the presidency, he delivered promises that slow and steady wins the race. It turns out he was wrong. As Donald Trump seems to be proving, brash and simplistic is more on trend this election season in the US. Bush, or Jeb exclamation mark, as he insisted on calling himself, dropped out of the race this weekend after receiving less than 10% of the vote in South Carolina. Now, Jane, some people could look at this and go, well, look, this is good. This would have been the third Bush president. America doesn't do dynasties, shouldn't do dynasties. This is a good thing for democracy. And yet those people tend to be in the same sort of camp who are incredibly alarmed, not just by Donald Trump, but by Ted Cruz, and would like to see a more centrist, if there is such a thing, Republican. Neither's really happy right now, are they?
No, there's many things to weigh up. I mean, this was probably quite welcome news for the Clinton camp, because they probably saw him as one of the more serious contenders out there. Trump has really made enormous strides and beaten many predictions, but still there are very few people who seem to think that he could win the presidency.
Phil, when you look at Jeb Bush's campaign, it was often, you'd look at it and you'd wonder sort of why people thought he was a good candidate. He wasn't a good politician, was he?
No, it was very odd, because if you think of how he ran his governorship in Florida, he was charismatic, he was well-organized, it was a really well-oiled machine. His run of the presidency was nothing of the sort. He sort of tactically delayed his announcement of running as late as possible in order to benefit from these, you know, very complex campaign funding rules. But as a result, it meant the population didn't know if he was running or not. And there seemed to be huge confusion around that. And then it meant his campaign kind of stuttered into life. And then when he was so far behind in the polls, he kind of quickly ran back to his family to say, well, can I get mummy and daddy and brother and nephew and uncle sort of out on the campaign trail, which was catnip to the Trump campaign. Trump could simply say about Jeb Bush, well, you know, you're hiding behind mummy's skirts here, and why don't you stand up and be a man, and all of this kind of thing. So, yeah, really kind of ham-fisted campaign from Jeb Bush.
Also, Jane, is it fair to say that the Republican Party had changed an awful lot since Jeb Bush was last seriously involved as governor of Florida? It's had the Tea Party movement. It's had the sort of the reaction to George W. Bush's last couple of years, which, you know, while people on the left saw all of the presidency as an absolute disaster, there were many people on the right who did not like the last couple of years and thought that he was spending too much money and shouldn't have bailed out the banks. It felt like Jeb Bush was running for the candidacy of a very different Republican Party.
I think that's right. I think the party has been fragmented and, you know, is going to face a divisive time to come. And you have this kind of outrage that manifests itself with the Tea Party, people who are really fed up of the political elite. Of course, to them, the surname Bush isn't good news to have that for the third time. But at the same time, the costs of running for president are so huge that you just don't get really genuine sort of left-field working class people coming through. And so they've strangely, many of them latched on to Trump, a billionaire, just because he appears to be a straight...
A billionaire who inherited his money as well.
Indeed.
The best kind. Phil, where do we go from here then? Yeah, many people have said, well, look, this is good, obviously very good for Marco Rubio. He becomes the sort of the establishment candidate, or at least the candidate who the Republican establishment will back. Whether he really is that far to the centre is perhaps up for debate. But does he become the main contender against Donald Trump?
I'm not so sure. I think Cruz still has a lot of wind in his sails. And I think we've seen that with the first couple of primaries. The next week is obviously hugely telling, you know, leading up to, as they call it, Super Tuesday. I think we're clearly going to find out a whole lot more there. But I think I agree exactly with what you and Jane have said so far, which is that there is this sort of brash, reactionary voice in all of this that seems to be winning the day. The more centrist, careful, calculating voice doesn't seem to be getting many votes. So I suspect this is going to be a Trump versus Cruz fight. I think Rubio may be increasingly sidelined as this whole process unfolds.
And Jane, as you said at the start, you know, perhaps Hillary Clinton is the person who's happiest about the departure of Jeb Bush. Do you think she would be looking forward to a general election where she's up against someone that she can paint as very far to the right?
That seems likely, because after Obama was perceived in US terms as fairly left-wing, or far left, as some would even say, I stress, in US terms, Clinton will probably paint herself as more of a centrist. She's also keener on sort of emphasising American exceptionalism, sort of liberal interventionism in some cases. She does have parts of her track record that could appeal to moderate Republicans as well.
Phil, it's interesting when you look at the polls, where, you know, because America polls obviously quite a lot and doesn't just look at, you know, what's going on in the primaries, but has done a lot of polls looking at potential general election matchups. You would imagine that Hillary would do better against Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, but it's actually Bernie Sanders who is picking up more of the vote when he's up against a Trump or a Cruz. What do you think that's about? Is that he is picking up similar support to Trump from the sort of the disaffected white working class vote?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think it's maverick versus maverick. It's voice of the disaffected versus voice of the disaffected. It's something unusual versus something unusual. I think what Clinton wants is as much predictability and as much caution on the Republican side. I think she would die to have Rubio as the opponent, and I think she's desperately worried
about... Just because it's more predictable than that. This is a straight centre-left versus centre-right. I know where I'm standing on this. I've got my arguments against this guy.
That's right. And I think even what we've seen with the Clinton versus Sanders fight so far is that Clinton has struggled to deal with the more maverick elements of Sanders' platform, that issues around campaign finance, issues around even aspects of foreign policy, where Sanders is quite weak, but he's landed a couple of blows. Clinton doesn't seem that agile. I'm sort of surprised by sort of her inability to kind of catch up with the times, you know, sort of blow with the new breezes. She seems to have decided this is my strategy and I'm going to wheel it out, you know, regardless of what happens. And I'm not sure that that's really the state of affairs in the US at the moment. The electorate seems much more volatile than that.
Okay, we've done the UK, we've done the US. We will move to the rest of the world in just a moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Monocle's annual Quality of Life Conference returns this April for 3 days of great conversations, inspiring panellists and peerless hosting. Set in Vienna, the conference will pull together people who care about running better businesses, brands, design studios, cities and even nations, and who are looking for global inspiration and new benchmarks for success. Up for discussion will be the future of communication in a world overwhelmed by digital content, how to make a nation. Monocle is launching this brand new book in Austria and will be bringing some star names from diplomacy, government and business to explain how good countries can deliver on quality of life for all. And we'll hear from players from around the globe who've discovered that you can create jobs and wealth with downtown ateliers and the sound of the odd hammer. Speakers such as chef and food writer Bill Granger, co-founder and director of Vienna Design Week Lily Holein, and the journalist and writer Gianni Riotta will share the stage with Monocle's editors and many, many more. Running from Friday afternoon to Sunday, with a focus on a full Saturday schedule, the conference is designed as a live event with elements broadcast here on Monocle 24. In between the debates, there'll be plenty of time to meet the editors, speakers, sponsors, and also your fellow readers and listeners. For more information and tickets, visit monocle.com. Be part of the discussion at the Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2016 from April 15th to the 17th. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And we do hope you can join us in Vienna for that. Right now, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Jane Killamont and Phil Clark. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has been re-elected and no one is surprised. Allegations of vote rigging, an opposition leader arrested, it's basically turned out like every other Uganda election since Museveni first took power in 1986. Phil Clark, it's interesting in a sense that there's been very little international coverage of what is quite a shocking situation taking place in a vitally important East African nation.
Yeah, I think there was a sense that the outcome was never in doubt and that the nature of the rigging was going to look almost exactly like the last three elections in Uganda. So most of the international press switched off. But I think that's really frightening in many ways, because one thing that characterized this election was that the violence in the lead up was greater than we've seen for a long time, definitely greater than the last two elections. And Museveni basically put these community police on the streets who were beating up political opponents and their supporters, beating up dissident journalists. There was a real atmosphere of fear around this election, which was in stark contrast to the last one. So this is a very, very troubling situation. The press should have been paying a lot more attention to this.
Jane Kinnamon, I've looked for a statement from Barack Obama. I've looked for a statement from David Cameron. Admittedly, they have perhaps other things on their mind at the moment. But indeed, across Europe and the Western world, there's been very little interest in what's just taken place in Uganda. Do you feel that this is because these countries feel they can't actually influence things as much anymore? Or is it the fact that it just wasn't on the radar?
Large parts of Africa are shockingly underreported. It would probably be a different story if huge quantities of Ugandans were coming to Europe in the way that the refugee crisis has placed the spotlight on certain places. In terms of influence, this is a country that has received substantial quantities of international aid in the past. I remember some years ago, Museveni was something of a donor's darling for
Bill Clinton fated him, Tony Blair fated him.
Absolutely, that time of the Commission for Africa when Uganda and Ethiopia were held up as great models but subsequently continued to go through quite significant violence. So you would think there were levers that could be used, but perhaps also a reluctance to highlight how sour a government that was so much supported by the West has gone.
Phil Clark, where do we go from here? Because, you know, as Jane just said, there is perhaps some influence that Western nations can have on Uganda. But it's tricky, isn't it? Because for all that, you know, European Union, America, UK might be like, well, we should we want to, you know, put some pressure on Museveni. He might well turn around and say, look, guys, I've sent many of my troops to Somalia to help you with your so-called war on terror. Dozens of them have died. Do you want me to pull them out?
Yeah, and Museveni's played that card extraordinarily well for the best part of 30 years now. He's a very close military ally of the US in particular. In fact, arguably, it's US training and US military materiel that's been used against the Ugandan population in the crackdown around these elections. So the US is playing a very direct role in militarizing the Ugandan state. I think the other major thing that comes out of this election is that the Ugandan opposition surely now has to go back to the drawing board. There was a hope this time that Besigye, who's the main opposition leader, his fourth attempt to try and unseat Museveni, might make some serious inroads. That hasn't worked. And the opposition in Uganda has suffered from the same thing that they've suffered from at the last few elections, which is they can never unite behind a single party or a single leader. They basically ate each other alive by splitting the vote between various parties. That strategy hasn't worked. Surely after four cracks at this, that they've got to find a different way of doing politics.
Finally today, let's turn to the issue of tax, particularly in the Gulf nations, many of which choose not to tax their citizens. But the leader of the International Monetary Fund has suggested that maybe that should change. Addressing finance ministers at the Arab Fiscal Forum in Abu Dhabi, Christine Lagarde said taxes were the lifeblood of modern states and pointed to falling oil prices as a key reason to implement new tax plans. Jane Kinnamont, this is tricky for a number of Gulf states because they have used oil money not just to ensure that many of their citizens don't have to pay tax, but also to pay for a lot of social benefits and provide a lot of jobs which perhaps aren't that crucial.
This is a massive issue for the Gulf with knock-on effects for the whole Middle East, and it's part of a wider global story where the dramatic and persistent fall in the price of oil is leading to a similarly dramatic redistribution of wealth on an international scale. In the Gulf, the social contract is going to be profoundly challenged if they do start taxing more and spending less. But it's not just the IMF that's saying it. Key leaders in the Gulf know that this has got to happen. It is more serious than similar suggestions in the past.
Phil Clark, if you were, you know, if you were advising the Saudi government right now, what would you be saying to them? Because it's not just about, as we just said before, it's not just about raising tax. It's also then about cutting back social spending.
Yeah, it is. That it's a really fundamental shift in how national wealth is used, and it's a fundamental change in state-citizen relations. You know, you're talking about populations that have become used to certain behaviour by their governments, and that may change now. I mean, I think the Saudis seem to be hoping that they don't have to go down that route. That they're sort of hoping that they can use their influence to alter the oil price internationally, trying to do deals with Iran and other countries to try and just fundamentally change the economics of this. That seems a very risky strategy because I'm not sure that we're in that kind of predictable international economic environment. So Saudi, I think, eventually is going to have to go down this kind of taxation line, but they will have to do it in a very, very slow way that prepares their population for a massive change.
Jane, just finally, is there any Gulf state that you think is thinking about this in the right way yet?
Saudi Arabia is talking the talk because they have younger leadership that seem to be trying to spin all this change as a positive thing, where some countries are just in denial about it, but nobody has really thought through in full the political implications of all of this.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Jane Kinnamont, Phil Clark, thank you both for your time today. And that's it for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Mike Hewin and Yasmin Omar. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music up next. Then at 1900, it's Culture with Robert Bound. Do stay tuned for that. It's The Daily at 2200. And Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.